These words from Mark's Gospel, chapter 8. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. And he said this plainly. And Peter took him and began to rebuke him. But turning and seeing his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are not on the side of God, but of men." And he called to him the multitude with his disciples and said to them, "If anyone would come after me, let them deny themselves and take up crosses and follow. For whoever would save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it." It's a remarkable consistency in Jesus' teaching in that he teaches us inconsistent things. This is right after Peter gets it right and calls Jesus the Christ, the Son of the living God. And then when Jesus alludes to what that means, Peter gets it wrong, and Jesus says paradoxically, those who save their lives will lose it, those who lose their lives will save it. Not unlike those who exalt themselves will be humbled, those who humble themselves will be exalted. Excuse me. And there is greater joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than 99 who are already righteous, and so on. There's this level of counterintuitive teaching that's very hard for people to get their heads around, people who think logically and orderly. Counterintuition, well, causes us to scratch our heads for a minute. Ran into a little counterintuition myself this week. I put an article, a research article, under review. And it's one in a long series of pieces we've done over the last 15 or so years on looking at the behavior and attitudes of people with body art and tattoos. We had already put into the mix the notion that people that have a tattoo or two are not especially different in what they believe or how they behave than generally anybody else. People with four or five or a few more, well, they're a little different. We've already said that beyond the threshold of four or five tattoos, these are folks that live with a little more edge to their lives, maybe a little more risk-taking, a little more drinking and other sorts of things. Well, this piece we put under review this week is it's in a similar vein. We looked at the relationship between escalating numbers of tattoos and well-being, self-esteem, depression, suicide thoughts, and even a history of suicide attempts. 2,400 college students, we found two things that were significant. That's it. That among our respondents with four or more tattoos, only the women were significantly more likely to report, and by significantly I mean 2 to 4 times more likely to report a history of attempted suicide. Only the women with 4+ tattoos. The other finding was that that same group, the women with 4+ tattoos, were the only group that had body art correlate with an emotion. And the emotion was self-esteem, and the correlation was positive. That is, the same group that reported 2 to 4 times more likely a suicide attempt also had significantly, substantially, statistically significantly higher self-esteem. What's up with that? We don't know. That's what counterintuition does for us. It forces us to ask new questions, forces us to put forward new theories. And the new theory we left at the end of the article, which is simply, we don't know, but we think this is going on, that in much the same way that we know cancer survivors sometimes get a tattoo to sort of metaphorically but also physically replace a lost body part, women, we think perhaps that women with a history of suicide attempts are, with more tattoos, seeking to replace an emotional loss. Who knows? But it was counterintuition that had us thinking at the next level. That's what I want to talk about today. I want to talk about counterintuition and what it does for us and how it may even draw us closer together. I want to apply some counterintuition to what at least some of us call in the academy a postmodern society, or the age of information. Have you noticed that we can pretty much answer any question we have with the touch of a smartphone button? Now the question is, where does the answer come from? I don't know, somewhere on the internet, Wikipedia or some such thing. Applying counterintuition to the idea of unlimited information says this: being highly informed is different than being well informed. You have to sort through to figure out what helps. I bet doctors go nuts when people come into their offices with reams of printouts from the internet and say, well, look what I found about this, that, and the other thing, and what do you think, etc. Well, where did you get this stuff? I have learned over the years, and I have had health questions that I have brought to bear on an internet search, I've learned that I go to two places. One, and I'm really lucky to be able to do this, through my access to Texas Tech's library, I can get electronic access to real articles in medical journals, the sacred texts that are kept from the rest of us, right? Well, you can actually read that stuff. It's not all that hard, really, and they tell you it's hard, I think, to separate, but you can actually read information in journals. The other place I go is the Mayo Clinic's website. I trust those folks and the places they go. Other places, not so sure. So well-informed requires some filtering through information. And at the last of it, I will have to say that when I'm in serious need of resolving something that frightens me or makes me anxious, I'm less likely to find relief on the internet than I am in the company of a friend, someone who cares about me. So the counterintuition to the age of information: look for the good stuff. Stay close to your people. Another place where counterintuition helps. You ever sit down and have a discussion with somebody about politics or religion? Once, and then you avoid it ever since, you know? Well, if you're into that sort of thing, there's a strategy. Debate teams know this. If you want to win an argument with somebody about politics or religion, find out what they believe about this and what they believe about something else, point out their logical inconsistency, and call them stupid. That sound like what happens at coffee shops, you know, or maybe the halls of Congress across the aisles? You said that about this, but this about that. What are you, nuts? Consistency is overrated. All it does is force us to continue saying and believing what we always thought or believed. I think that's counterproductive. One of the better examples of how this works out is when you have two people talking about the obvious inconsistency that most people have when they talk about what might be referred to as pro-life issues and capital punishment. Both sides of that question tend to have inconsistent views. We're pro-life here, but not so much there. We're pro-life here, but not so much, etc. And these discussions tend to confine themselves to maybe what we would call the pre-born or the sociopaths and so on. And both sides of those questions, whether it be sort of left-leaning or right-leaning, have logical inconsistencies, which I think is a good thing, frankly. I think those logical inconsistencies force us to raise new questions and advance the debate in more productive ways. It seems to me that a pro-life agenda can be expanded to include more than just the quote-unquote pre-born, which raises all kinds of interesting issues about how do we care for children after they're born? What do we create in our world with respect to schools, hospitals, access to health care for the next phase of one's life? So also a discussion of crime and violence raises all manners of, I think, useful questions for both discussion and research. What's the relationship between violence and culture? And how does a violent act here relate to a violent act there? And it's only through understanding the logical inconsistencies that these other questions begin to come up and cause us to think a little more profoundly and, oddly enough, maybe build bridges across the aisles, if you will. I think logical consistency is overrated because every decision has to occur at a moment in time, and moments in time have different contexts. Counterintuition, Logical consistency is overrated. It's not irrelevant. Ask anyone who's tried to raise children. But it's overrated in that it locks us into a position that from which we can mostly only hit each other over the head, and that's not helpful. The information age, logical consistency. And finally, and on point for Jesus' command that those who lose their lives will save it and who save their lives will lose it, I think the fear of death is overblown. Death is not always the enemy. Front page of today's paper, a well-known clergyman in Lubbock, Ted Dotz, who I've known for nearly 20 years and consider him a good friend, is simply getting out of the way of what will become the end of his life much sooner than later. And Ted is an example of what took off in our country mid-90s, I would say, with the publication of a piece of research in the Journal of the American Medical Association that pointed out that people in teaching hospitals and who are dreadfully ill tend to die under dreadful circumstances, in great pain, under the threat of CPR and feeding tubes and all this stuff. And we have now moved, the hospice movement has helped this quite a bit, the medical profession has begun to see that peaceful death is good medicine. And Ted is asking for and will presumably experience in fairly short order peaceful death. It is not always the enemy. Now, most of us in this room are not in the situation where we perhaps have a 50-50 chance of living out the year. That may or may not be the case, but we don't know much about it right now. But death is still not the enemy. I think there's a lot of religious rhetoric that scares us about what might happen at the end of our lives. And it only scares us because the end of our lives is inevitable. We know two things for sure. Everything that lives, and I'm not just talking about human beings, I'm talking about rose bushes and tadpoles and cats and rattlesnakes. Everything where life starts, that life ends. What happens next? Well, the church will tell us, you better watch out, you better not cry. No, that's a little bit different, but it's the same story, you know. And if there is a judgment, let's just hypothetically say that, we spend our lives trying to stack the deck. You know, I hope we get a good verdict on that because we're not perfect, but maybe we're better than most, and then that sets in motion a whole bunch of stuff on earth. If judgment is what judgment must be from an all-powerful Creator God, the verdict comes down after the first sin. That's it. It only takes one. Jesus dies to forgive us all our sins or none of them, which means we have no control over it. What we have control over is life in the meantime. And we don't have a lot of time, actually. I'm compelled by what Roger Ebert, the film critic, whose life was ending in the same way that Ted's life is ending, and whose life ended a couple of years ago, and he's an agnostic. He said, I don't know much about religion. I'm not sure much about God, but I know that I have no notion of where I was the day before I was born. Presumably, I was in a safe place. I have no notion of where I'll be the day after I die, but it will presumably be no different. So death doesn't scare me. I have this day to live in the best way I know. The information age needs a filter. Logical consistency is overrated. Death is not the enemy. Jesus says, those who lose their lives for my sake will save them. How do you lose your life for Jesus' sake? I mean, I suppose there's martyrdom and all of that, but I think more profoundly, let's think of it this way. It is now 11:30. In a half hour, the first half of January 11th, 2015 will be gone. And by midnight, the second half will be gone. We have lost a day of our lives. We've lost half of this day, and in 12 and a half hours, the next day will start. And as that day progresses, we will also lose it. How do we lose it for His sake? I was struck by something I picked up on that third place in the internet where you can get credible information. I mean, there's the medical journals and the Mayo Clinic's website, and then there's Facebook. And what came across was an essay directed at college students, particularly college men pledging fraternities. And the essay hypothetically said that what college men pledging fraternities are told is, we want you to join us so you can be a man. Well, what does that mean? Stereotypically, it means drink a lot, enjoy the conquests of women, work hard to make a lot of money. Stereotypically, be a man. And how is that different? This is where the essay moves to the next level. How is that different than what might be said about a man in a eulogy who was a good man? Be a man, he was a good man. A good man, eulogized, would likely be described in terms of generosity, wisdom, gentleness, tolerance. I think that's a useful distinction, because we have all sorts of definitions about the kinds of people we need to be at a particular stage in our lives. But I would suggest that for the next 12 hours of January 11th, 2015, and perhaps the portion of January 12th where you will be awake, you consider what you might be about that would be described as, today, he was a good man. Today, she was a good woman. Gentleness, wisdom, tolerance, forgiveness, good humor, living our lives, losing our lives each day for Jesus' sake, as he would have it be. Amen.